if you were trying to organize workers, gig economy workers, which is difficult because they're a very heterogeneous and atomized group, I think that any way to speak to people's sense of honor is one of the most basic things that you can do, right? Any to get more specific, you start fracturing it more. But to go back to what I was mentioned before about these sort of substitute social formations, these substitute societies on the right, is that they are reimaginings of like honor. Like that is their basic appeal. But I think that is the latent moral economy. People,
it's a question of dignity. Because I mean, I guess honor and dignity not being exactly the same. I wonder if you think that it's one more than the other.
One thing I would hear a lot is a sort of a critique of disposability. Just this feeling that people are they're not even worthy of the time to be fired. Like you could just automatically be deactivated, or if you have an interaction with a customer, they don't even have to like look you in the eyes. It's a very basic thing, but I think that speaking to it, that is, I think probably the most basic shared framework, and I think that's where like a lot of the people who are trying to organize gig workers, that is usually at the level that they begin with.
Well, and there's a basis for universality there, which claims of justice or injustice aren't able to meet because of different conceptions of what justice would be.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to BungaCast. I'm Alex Hochuli in São Paulo, Brazil. And joining me today is Will Charles, who's assistant professor of sociology at Miami University in Ohio and studies organizational sociology with an emphasis on work, platforms, and technology. Hi, Will. Good to have you on.
Thanks for having me on.
So I'm quite excited to talk to Will because a year or two ago, Will got in touch to share some of his work with me on legitimacy following, I think, a comment he posted on our Patreon. Is that right? And unfortunately, didn't have the chance to give it the time that it deserved. But following our recent episode on Muskism, I remembered it because it was very, the stuff that Will had sent me through touches very directly on the discussion we had on Muskism and some of the critiques and questions that we had about this notion of Muskism, whether we live in the age of Muskism and whether that in some way is a correlate to the Fordism that obtained in mid-century. Anyway, so I had to look at Will's work and realize it was really bang on the money. And the more I thought about it, the more relevant his work seemed to recent discussions we've had on the podcast. So just to introduce this discussion, I thought I'd reference some of those episodes to explain why I find Will's work so useful in tying a bunch of different elements together, which you, listener, I assume will have accompanied if you are indeed a regular listener of this podcast. So firstly, regarding Muskism, we found that unlike Fordism or even what is called post-Fordism, Muskism seemed no longer to need to legitimate itself. Indeed, that was a question we put to our guests in that episode last month. Mid-20th century Fordism was a way of managing mass society by paying people higher wages, to put it very, very, to put it in very abbreviated form. Then post-Fordism, which roughly overlaps with neoliberalism, was about managing and motivating atomized individuals in a post-mass society. It sold self-management as a form of freedom. Then Muskism, if that is indeed the age in which we live, might be something different. And we'll leave that question open for now. But this also pertains to discussions we've had with Benjamin Studebaker about his work on legitimacy in an episode last year, namely that we exist in a condition of deep pluralism. We don't believe the same things, we don't accord on the same facts, and we may even dispute how one achieves knowledge on a subject. Especially in the embedded democracies like the US and the UK, this chronic situation ends up not producing regime change or civil war, but just gridlock and sclerosis. We can see an analogy to this sort of discussion in the international arena. The waning of American hegemony is resulting in a post-hegemonic scenario. This is also a question of legitimacy. So let's see, for example, how the Trump administration barely even attempts to justify taking Greenland or abducting Maduro or bombing Iran. This seems to be an age in which legitimation is no longer even necessary. It's a post-hegemonic sort of order or disorder. And I think it accompanies the transformation in multilateralism or the decay of multilateralism. So I would suggest you, listener, if you're interested in more on that, to go check out our recent episode on post-multilateralism. And there's a couple of other touch points as well. We have a recent reading club in which we looked at the 1950s so-called end of ideology, an earlier age in which capitalism seemed to give up providing big normative or ethical justifications for itself. And then finally, we have our recent episode with Dylan Riley on secular stagnation and a type of capitalism that's no longer focused on increasing production or improving productivity, but on capturing wealth and transferring it upwards. How does such an order justify itself? Now, you can find all these episodes linked in the show notes below, but I would urge listeners to subscribe to our Patreon if they want access to the full episodes. I'm biased, but I do think it's worth it. I found those conversations very enriching, and I'm looking forward to starting this one now and talking a little bit less and bringing Will in. So firstly, I want to talk about post-legitimacy and then move on to Muskism and then finish off with some wider questions. So Will, to get started, thinking about the gig economy, a lot has been said and written about the gig economy, a lot of propaganda about the gig economy. So let's start there. What's the optimistic account of how the gig economy should work? Why should people buy into it, at least according to its advocates?
Oh, yeah. So in the early days of the gig economy, there was sort of a legitimating narrative with it. And it had to do with sort of value capture. It was after the 2008 sort of financial crisis, and a lot of households were squeezed. People were looking sort of for ways to make ends meet. And it sort of offered itself as a way to, you know, control your own work. You didn't have a boss. You could work when you wanted. And in the early days, because there was so much venture capital flowing into it, the platforms were actually subsidizing consumption and production on the platform. So the wages were actually relatively high. And the way that academics sort of justified it was that it was a way to cut out the middleman. It was pretty much a way to capture more value. So you wouldn't have to basically go through an intermediary. I mean, the platforms eventually became, you know, they are intermediaries that are taking like 30 to 50% of the transactions. But in the early days, they were paying quite well relatively to a lot of other opportunities. I mean, in the context of the US, where you don't really have a welfare state, this was the type of sort of employment as last resort. And they also sort of had a sheen of technological innovation. They were trying to sort of attract a lot of middle-class people who otherwise might have not have worked in the service sector. So, you know, I interviewed people in Boston in, 2013, 14, and, you know, some of them were, you know, coming from relatively affluent backgrounds who were looking for just ways to sort of have play money to maybe pay back some debt. But as far as its sort of technical and normative justifications, it was really an efficiency framework organized around disintermediation. You have this sort of like this lowering of transaction costs, which makes it possible to sort of have this sort of horizontal type of organization. So people were sort of hopeful. There was even, platform cooperativist movement, the sort of thought that you could have new types of work arrangements where these were almost like a traditional style cooperatives, but enabled by the technology. So there was some justification in the early days trying to make an argument about how it would basically transfer value back downward to people.
Right. And I guess even if people didn't buy that argument, I think the argument about autonomy, that the autonomy it would provide workers, that was something that people bought into, at least to some degree. And we'll get on to, I guess, the degree to which some of these discourses and narratives are actually bought into. But this also touches on a kind of wider ideological question, which is that of post-Fordism, which set itself up as, well, basically some